Jorma Kaukonen, a founding member of Jefferson Airplane and Hot Tuna, and just has recorded so many albums and done so much music with so many people. He's our guest in the second hour. Jorma has written a biography. It's called Been So Long, My Life in Music. He's going to talk about Jefferson Airplane and Hot Tuna, but trust me, there is bluegrass content in this man's veins, and we're going to talk about the influence of Earl Scruggs, the Carter family, on Jorma Kaukonen. It all makes sense, and it will, with my guest Jorma Kaukonen. He's always been into country blues and bluegrass, and it shows. He will describe his style in our discussion in the second hour. Very special guest, Jorma Kaukonen. I'm really happy to welcome back to Unreal Bluegrass, Jorma Kaukonen. How have you been, Jorma?
Oh, it's been great. It's been great, and it's great talking to you. It's been too long.
It's been too long. I was surprised it was almost a little more than 5 years ago. And
Holy moly.
I know. The impetus now for us to talk is this great new book that you've just released. Came out the end of August of this year, So Long, My Life in Music. And it's a blast. I just absolutely loved reading it and all the little...
Oh, thanks, man.
All the little eddies and the little tours and the different things that you went through. And I'm going to take a little bit... I don't want to let go of all the secrets of the book because people want to buy it. First of all, there's a five-song CD that's snuck in the back, which is pretty cool also.
Yeah, those are from all... You know, I don't want to attach too much importance to the sequence and stuff, but it sort of follows the emotional tenor of the book, and they're all live recordings from various different periods, which is kind of cool.
And they're great. Throughout this book, I've noticed you're always asking questions, actual questions. I think you're asking them to use to yourself sometimes. They also you're asking the reader to think about why these things occur. So when someone's reading your book, they kind of have to be engaged and be a little bit reflective about, you know, this thing in this part of your life, this happened. Why does this happen? You don't always answer it. You just kind of put out these questions for the reader to think about. Why do these things occur? And I wonder why these things happen, which I thought was kind of a neat way to interact with the reader.
Well, I wish I could take conscious credit for doing that, but I think that's just the way I think.
Yeah, well, no, it's just okay. That's okay. The book, last time we talked a lot about your bluegrass connections, and we also talked a lot about Fur Piece Ranch, which I want to talk about again, because now I think, as I read the bio, Jorma, I think that Fur Piece Ranch is kind of a resolution of a lot of issues that throughout the book, I think I don't know how to describe it, but it's like it's a goal for you, and it helps resolve a lot of issues and just things in your life. It seems to be a place that you can be comfortable in.
Yeah, I think, that's a good point. And again, I don't think that I thought about it in quite those terms until you brought it up like that. But, you know, if you think about the journey that life is for all of us, it's nice when you get to a destination that is someplace that you really need to be and it serves your needs, and that certainly has been the case for me.
Well, and it does kind of come up at certain points in your life where the opportunity, by the way, the red thread, I think the red thread that you mentioned late in the book is a very good description of things in your life, and I think it applies to everyone as far as the Chinese proverb that basically there's a thread that connects everybody, and sooner or later it all comes back around, and you're destined to kind of be and meet the people that you meet. And I think that maybe Fur Piece Ranch is not at the end of the red thread, but it's a good chunk away.
I wouldn't think so either, but it's certainly a nice waypoint. And right now, you know, it occupies so much of my wife's, Vanessa, and my life, because her more than me, because she really ramrods the whole thing. But it's a cool place to be. And one of the things that we really enjoy about it, because it's a lot of work, more work for her than me, because I'm on the road as I talk to you. I'm not home working on the ranch right now. She is. But you know, in a way, we really consider that we are providing... I hesitate to use the word spiritual service in that sense.
Go ahead.
Self-important.
Go with that. Go with that, because I know what you're going to say.
Yeah. I mean, we provide a refuge for like-minded spirits where guys like you and me and a lot of the different people we know that love different kinds of music can get together in a non-confrontational way, and not just the great instructors we have, and just share that common love of music, again, with like-minded spirits. I mean, you just don't find that when you're on the subway, you know?
No, No, let's talk about the book a little bit. You start very early on in your family, and as a lot of people may have known about Yorma, your musical career, bits and pieces of it, but you go back and put yourself back in growing up. You traveled a lot more than maybe people realize. You were in Europe, you were in the Philippines, you were back and forth with family issues, and they all seemed to inform what you were becoming and music you were being exposed to.
You know, it's funny because, you know, we all live the life we live, and we kind of take it for granted in that that's how things are. However, when I look at the way my life has evolved, I've had an interesting life. And again, that sounds self-serving to say. My wife goes, "Yeah, you've really had an interesting life." And I'm going, "Really? It's just kind of my life." But when you think about it, you know, I was really fortunate. My dad, you know, had various jobs that required that he travel around and that he'd be able to take his family with us. And we got a chance to do that. So I got turned on to a lot of cultures, a lot of music. And one of the things, I was talking to an interviewer yesterday about this. One of the things I think that traveling so much as a youngster in other parts of the world did for me that has made me, well, for lack of a better word, a better person today, certainly more understanding person in some ways, is what it feels like to be a minority in another culture.
Oh, good
point. You know, if I'd grown up, of course, you know, the United States is such a heterogeneous country, you know, unless you just live in some area where people don't travel. Kind of like where I live today, you know. Most of the people there don't travel a lot, but even there, in spite of themselves, more cosmopolitan than they once were. But in any case, you know, to live in some country where, as a white American, you're absolutely a minority, that's a good experience. It's a good way. It's a good thing to look at the world. Hey, I'm not the only game in town. You know?
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point to draw from that experience because you certainly were back and forth a lot. And
absolutely.
The other thing that we learn early in the book, not only is Yorma pulled to the music of the guitar, you're also pulled to motorized vehicles of all kinds.
Exactly. Yeah, I don't, you know, you look at stuff like that and you wonder, what am I? Am I just a crash materialist? I don't know, maybe. But, you know, for me, like my, I have a 21-year-old son, and he drives and he has a motorcycle, also, all this kind of stuff, and he loves it. But it's not the same thing for him, and I can see that. And I just let it go because, you know, because it's not the same thing for him. But for me, it was always, even, you know, bicycles, motorcycles, cars, it was always a real freedom machine. And honestly, it still is. I love driving around, and I still like mechanical gadgets. Now, I don't like working on them anymore because they've mutated into a place where you kind of have to have a...
You have to be a computer expert.
Yeah, exactly. It's a new ballgame. But the good news is they don't really need much. I just recently... You know, I think I'm going to post it on my blog in a day or so. I bought this Cummins Turbo V8 pickup truck. It's a big monstrous thing, which I really didn't need, but I got a chance to get a good deal, and I've always wanted one, and now I have one. And I saw a picture of my wife driving the other day, and well, you know, how good does it get? It's a pretty lady driving a big silver pickup truck, and it's a turbo diesel. What's not to like, really, you know?
I think you're right. You know what, as far as the guitar playing and your approach to playing, which you spell out very, very carefully and progressively in the book, you've come back on this. And a lot of musicians I found focus on, if they're string instruments or playing guitar or whatever, focus on their right hand. And that seems to be a real focus of you throughout all of your playing.
Absolutely. You mentioned Earl Scruggs' right hand. I absolutely believe that whatever your style is, whether it's finger style, whether you wear picks, you don't wear picks, whether it's flat picking, whatever, whether it's hybrid, whatever your style is, the right hand is the most important hand. And Roy Bookbinder, God bless him, who's always coming up with these witty aphorisms, says, your left hand is what you know, but your right hand is who you are. And I totally believe that.
That's part of that thing, too, and I forget who you reference it to, but I've heard in reference to Earl Scruggs that he could play his banjo, and then he could play your lesser banjo, and it would still sound just like Earl Scruggs.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
You know, since we mentioned Earl again, when I learned Jimmy Brown, the Newsboys, one of the first songs that I learned it with a flat pick because that's what I was doing back then. But when I found out later on that Earl actually played that song on the guitar, and when you listen to what he does, is he's quote-unquote finger-picking, but it's not like what I do.
No.
It's absolutely from... You know, from the universe of a banjo player, and it is so interesting.
You know, if I did this, as I'm reading your book, since I got it early, thank you very much to your people.
You're welcome.
I would have music playing in the background. It kind of helps me focus anyway, but I would suggest a Spotify channel for My Life in Music, been So Long My Life in Music. And I would put these tunes in the Spotify channel for just that book. I would put Jimmy Brown, Flatten Scruggs. I would put some Jody Reynolds, Endless Sleep. I would put Ian Buchanan. I'd put Reverend Gary Davis and Blind Blake. Many of these, by the way, I didn't know about Blind Blake or Ian Buchanan, but they are really, and sometimes it's ragtime music, but it helps illustrate. And I would also put Quah. I think Quah has to run throughout while you're reading the book. And I also would play Takes Off, the first Jefferson Airplane album.
Yeah, absolutely. A bona fide folk rock album.
Yeah. Just to kind of get into that. And that'll get you through two-thirds of the book, and then you can put in some of the later Jefferson Airplane. But all of those things that I noticed from you and that you're listening to, which I went and found and listened to thanks to you, the right hand is just strong as a rock.
Yeah, it really is, you know. And I, you know, one of the things that when I'm teaching, that's the hardest thing to get across, you know, depending on what vision your student has. You know, a lot of guitar players, they start thinking about the licks and it's all important. I understand that. However, you know, the groove as manifested by whatever your right hand does, it's just the whole ball of wax, and you just got to, you know, sometimes it's hard to get people to focus on that. They want to play the hot licks. They want to do this. They want to do that. And I go, you can't do that without a right hand.
I heard, I think it was Oscar Peterson. I'm not trying to show all these names, but I saw Oscar Peterson interview. He was talking about Art Tatum, who was like, as Oscar Peterson was a god to everyone that followed him, Art Tatum was a god to Oscar Peterson.
Yeah.
And Art Tatum told him, it's your right hand that does it. The left hand is just everything, you know, all the other stuff. But it's the right hand that really guides what you're doing on the piano keyboard. And for some reason, that seems to be the same. Seems to be the same throughout.
I totally get it, yeah.
Yeah, it's the timing. It's always being there. I don't know if it's the bass. The bass drives it. I don't know what it is. I can't think that deep. But you can feel it. You can feel it. I can't express it. You can express it. I can feel it, but I can't express it in words.
Well, I'm not sure I can express it either. But whatever you're saying, ditto.
the book takes through that early stage in your life where you're traveling around and you're gaining these exposures. You're always searching for the right instrument and the right talismans. You talk about having all the talismans, and having been there myself, I'm going to get this. I want to get this kind of thing. I'm going to do this because then I'll sound just like whatever in my head I'm supposed to sound like. But you're always sort of gathering bits and pieces and making all the stuff around you as you play. And you use the word talismans, which I thought was a perfect description.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's funny, for whatever reason, the guitar absolutely requested my presence at an early age. But I liked fretted instruments, and when I was in Antioch, right around the time that I met Ian, and he was really mentoring me in a very profound way, my roommate was a five-string banjo player, and I've somehow weaseled my way into a five-string banjo because they're cool looking. I liked it. And I messed around with it for a while, but it wasn't complete enough for whatever vision was evolving in me, in that I wasn't really much of a joiner back then. And the fact that as a fingerstyle guitar player enabled me to play solo, that was really important. I still, and so when I'd get together with my buds to play bluegrass and old time or whatever you wanted to call that Americana stuff back then, I was more than happy to play rhythm because, again, I had a really strong right hand.
Right.
But in terms of where I was going to go, the banjo, it just didn't suck me in the way it sucks banjo players in. So when I got my first J50, which I got for $100 at Pop's Music Store in Dayton, Ohio, I traded the banjo in also.
Well, so there. I mean, it served its purpose.
Now, that said, I still own two banjos. I've got a Gibson RB-130,
oh, nice.
And I have some Brit long neck thing that looks like a Pete Seeger banjo. And every now and then, I try to learn clawhammer, which I really like, but it's so utterly alien to everything I've spent my life doing, I've just never got that.
This is not my description, but if you're talking clawhammer versus, let's say, three finger or scrug, it's toes in versus toes out on the dancing stage.
Well said.
And I stole that from somebody else. I share a name with him, but that was his quote, so I think it fits pretty well. So the interesting thing about this book too is that it takes the reader through, you know, Jefferson Airplane, just how it sort of kind of, it sort of gathers up its own steam, the early makeup of the band, and even while Jefferson Airplane is in its heights, we'll say, of what I recognize as being in the heights of the power of right. Jefferson Airplane, you're still the essence of Hot Tuna is forming.
Yeah, and again, you know, this is one of these things that people wonder, were you thinking about a spinoff band and all? And the answer is absolutely not.
No.
You know? I mean, you know, the airplane, we got lucky, we became big stars for a while, and you think that stuff's going to last forever and everything. I mean, I didn't think about mutating into something else, but there's the guitar, and like the first Hot Tuna record, and subsequently some of the electric jams we did, they just evolved because they were fun to do, and we had the time to do it, et cetera, et cetera. And we didn't have to support ourselves doing that because that was taken care of by the very long, you know, it's hard to stop a train. The Jefferson Airplane is a very long train.
Absolutely,
for a while.
Yeah.
So, and that's kind of paid all the freight. We got a free pass on learning who we're going to be next.
Well, and it was perfect because I remember talking to you about this before, and we've covered some of these things, and now they're nice and there in the book for people to read and ruminate. And I do suggest listen to some of the music that you discuss while it's being read, because it helps time things, at least does for me, is the way my brain works. But I remember talking to you before about, it wasn't like your Hot Tuna adventure was, you weren't escaping from Jefferson Airplane. That was just another part of what you wanted to do, and you were always, you describe yourself as never really being a lead guitar player.
No, I mean, I certainly came in, you know, once again, you can't make this stuff up. I mean, once again, I got in a band that became, you know, I was utterly unqualified. I was a guitar player, certainly, but, you know, to fill the bill, the traditional bill that lead guitar players had filled up to that point, I was utterly unqualified for that. But the good news was that the Jefferson Airplane was such an odd-ass band anyway, that we weren't a blues band, we weren't a traditional rock band, that there was a lot of room to discover who you might want to be. And everybody in the band always gave everybody an opportunity to do that, you know. And that's not, I mean, if I'd been like an, I don't know, for lack of a better band, if I'd been auditioning for Paul Revere and the Raiders, I could never have made the, you know, I just don't, I wouldn't have made that band. I wouldn't have made that cut, you know. But the airplane had no boundaries about doing stuff like that.
I can't imagine at this point interviewing Norm McCalkin about his career with Paul Revere and the Raiders. So
I'll take that because it was a pretty odd.
I know. I like it. It's a nice visual, though, with the hat.
Yeah. But anyhow, so I got into the band, and then I got a chance to discover another aspect of myself, you know, which was to play electric guitar. And when we do workshops at the ranch that involve the electric guitar, in my description, and when people show up for the class, I go, look, I'm not going to teach you a solo from We Can Be Together or from Hopcorn or something like that, because that's not how I think about stuff, you know. I mean, when you play a song, obviously you play the song, and it's moderately similar most of the times you play it, you know. But if you want to learn Hideaway, go to a guy like G.E. Smith. He knows how to play all these you know, these classical solos.
Yeah.
But that's not me. So my thing with electric guitar workshops is to try to encourage the people in the class to find a way to create a sonic landscape that pleases them rather than trying to clone a Yorma solo from hit single number one or something like that.
Well, and you throughout the book, you describe the fact that you're listening, but you were never trying to clone. Maybe early on you wanted to sound like a sound, like I do remember the fact that you saw the Love and Spoonful, and maybe you heard their guitars and what they were playing, and you wanted to get those. Turns out they weren't that crazy about the sound that you thought was the sound to get your hands on.
Yeah, yeah. We hated those hands. We had to stand out. We hated them. We had to use them because they endorsed us.
Right.
I went, well, Standell amp is the sound of the lead guitar sound of somebody loving White Rabbit. Worked out okay for me.
It did work out well. And then again, that's your, it worked out great, but you know, then we get back, we kind of close the loop on this whole thing at your right hand.
Yeah, of course. You know, and that's, you know, recently I had to, last year I got involved with this thing where there's a thing that was done by some of the guys that are on the board of directors of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, one of whom is the president of Ohio State University, Michael Drake.
Yeah.
And we're doing a thing at the Shadowbox in Columbus, and they wanted me to back this girl singer who was going to sing White Rabbit. So I said, I've been, you know, when I play White Rabbit with like Teresa Williams or my friends, you know, whatever, I've been fudging my way through that single for years because I just forgot what I did. But I realized that at this point, it might behoove me to actually learn my own solo. So I downloaded it on iTunes for 99 cents. And I set up an app on our little stage at the Fur Peach Ranch, and I spent an afternoon learning that solo. And it's cool. Now I got it. Now I can do it anytime I want.
Was this Rachel Price you were going to play with?
Yeah, well, no. This no. wasn't Rachel. That was a lock. And no, I fudged my way through that one.
Okay.
I need to go over that again. Rachel, come back.
Well,
I love her, by the way.
Oh, isn't she amazing?
One
yeah.
of the things that manifested itself to me was I couldn't create a solo like that today to save my soul because I know too much stuff now. I had no idea what I was doing back then. I was just chasing the chords. And I came up with something really cool. And when I, you know, because when I was able to reconstruct the fingering and the right hand and all this kind of stuff, I realized, man, this is so out of left field. I just don't think like that anymore.
Well, you didn't have a template you had to follow then. Now you're following yourself.
Sure, exactly.
Interesting. Well, at least you got a little part of the 99 cent download, maybe.
Oh, totally. It was worth every penny.
You mentioned later throughout the book, you describe your singing voice, and which is, I think, become really, really recognized. Well, certainly through Hot Tuna, but you do talk about high lonesome vocals. Now, you don't tie it into high lonesome sound of bluegrass.
I don't, because
I don't think it strikes you that way, but you do have that vocal sound, and you're not trying to be Bill Monroe. I wouldn't suggest that for a minute, but that is kind of how you refer to your own vocal abilities.
You know, that high tenor thing was never in my range anyway.
No.
But I really love that stuff, you know. Why? Who knows why? Well, a lot of people love it. It's cool sounding. But you know, some of those funny bluegrass phrases where they'll finish a phrase with da-da-da-da-da-da-da, you know, like
yeah.
one of those little things.
Yeah.
I do a lot of that stuff. I'm not a bluegrass singer, but
no.
but I like a lot of that stuff, and it pops up in my singing all the time.
You mentioned the Carter family again later on in the book. So you're always pulled back in that, and that could just be the right hand again. Maybe you're looking for that.
Maybe.
I don't know.
And the essence of the songs also, I mean, you know, first of all, I guess who doesn't love a murder ballad, really? You
right.
know? but the essence of the songs, I mean, the narrative, you know, the textural narrative of the Carter family stuff was just always so cool. And to be honest with you, it still is.
And you at Antioch College, we talked about this before, and those passages are in the book. And I don't want to read the book to people. I don't want to take your time, and they should buy it and read it. But at Antioch College gave you a good opportunity to kind of experience a lot of those roots country blues type things, and you absorbed all those, I think. And that's still where it's not where your heart is. Your heart is where you are now. But I mean, I do think that sound in your head kind of wheels around that.
Oh no, absolutely. You know. Once again, I couldn't have picked a better place for who I was going to become to go to college for a couple of years than Antioch, because Antioch was just filled with that kind of music. I mean, it was, and I doubt seriously that any other quote unquote major schools would have had that influence whatsoever.
No, and I still think it has that reputation, at least that feel to it. I don't know what goes on there now, but I think at the time it was
whatever
perfect.
It is, I'm sure it's still weird.
I think it's still different. You,
I don't doubt.
The book talks. You discuss in length of your marital relationship, the strain of being this traveling musician. And other things that creep into your life, and many people, and through the 60s and beyond, any addictive personalities that you had, things of those come up in the book. And also, this tickled me when the Jefferson Airplane gets the cover of Life magazine. It's kind of like when your dad like gives you the thumbs up.
Yeah, that was it. Right. That's
you know,
funny.
It's kind of interesting. I get the fact that you want to be on wheels. I get the fact that you want to move. But there's a part of the book where later on you become obsessed with ice skating, speed skating.
Yeah, we just, you know, in some ways that may have helped to prolong my life. Again, why, you know? I mean, I just remember, it's in the book, but 1972, I skated a little bit when I was a kid, you know. I never really pursued it. I always enjoyed it. You know, there is that, you know, if you skate, there is that feeling, that sort of feeling of freedom. It's almost like you get something from nothing because of the way you glide. I mean, you don't, but, you know. But anyway, I mean, just watch that speed skating stuff on the TV in 1972, and it just looked like a lot of fun. And once I got into it, I mean, I remember in the beginning, I mean, it's funny the stuff you think. I remember thinking, well, I can skate. How hard could it be? Well, the answer is, it could be really hard. And it took a lot of work. But for some reason, the work part of it became important to me also. So we actually trained. I got to know a lot of the guys who were world class back in that days. You know, maybe they tolerated us because I was, you know, a refugee from a famous rock band. Who knows? A lot of those guys I'm still friends with today. But it just was a lot of fun, and, you know, the camaraderie, that athletic camaraderie, and the fact that I had no pressure on myself. I mean, you know, with the metric skating thing, you only really compete against your own time.
Oh, that's true.
You know, I was already, I mean, even in my late 30s, I was already way over the hill in terms of being competitive, et cetera, et cetera. But I just loved it. I really did. And I spent a lot of time and wasted a lot of money.
Well, I was going to say, you went over periodically, and then you kind of ran out of money and realized you had to come back.
Right, exactly.
So you were feeding that habit of becoming the speed skater.
Yeah.
I thought it was fascinating.
Yeah, I will say that a couple of years ago, I have a 12-year-old daughter, and when she was skating like 4 years ago or something like that, I can do this, you know, and I bought another pair of skates, and I went out, and I could kind of do it. But I realized that an inherent part of skating is falling. And I don't really need to be falling at this point in my life. So I put them aside. I put them aside and let the kids do it.
Listen, there are pictures in the middle of the book where you got the pose, man. You're at the line. You're ready to take off. You were serious about this stuff.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, I was absolutely serious about it.
You're still performing. And I know that you and Jack still appear different places around.
Yep.
Oh, by the way, and this interview was set up before Marty Balin died, and I just wanted to tell you how sad that was for all of us. I can't imagine being inside that community, but you know, everyone my age and certainly, you know, took that as a loss.
Yeah, I mean, there's no good time for bad news. And, you know, one of the things that's unfortunate, I mean, you know, Marty was younger than me, and obviously, you know, you get to a point in your life when even though I'm not a kid, but people that are my age that are dying, it's like, that's just too damn young.
Yeah.
And there was so unfortunate about Marty, and it came as a shock to all of us. But you know, one of the things that seems to be happening is, as you get older, you wind up saying goodbye more than you say hello, and sometimes that's just the way it is.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I went back and relearned some of his early stuff before Jefferson Airplane, things he was into. Really fascinating guy musically, I thought.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. He was a really interesting guy. And you know, Marty was really, you know, he sort of like lost control or whatever, however you want to look at it, of the band as things evolved with Paul and Grace. But if it hadn't been for Marty in the beginning, there wouldn't have been a band.
No, I think everything I read and what you've told me in the past, that's absolutely true. There's a foreword from Grace Slick and there's an afterword from Jack Cassidy to this book, which kind of brings us to the point of getting back with you to talk. The book has been So Long, My Life in Music. It's on St. Martin's Press, and there's so many things. We can't cover them all, but it's Jorma's life from different points of view and different things that occurred. And in the very last page, it basically says you're still learning.
Yep.
You're the next to last paragraph, you say, look, I'm still trying to, and I'm paraphrasing, but I'm still figuring this stuff out myself.
Well, you know, I think it would be a bad moment if I couldn't say that.
Well, no, yeah. If you ever reach the point when you're self-realized, then you've done something wrong, fully.
I would think, or you're fooling yourself.
That's right. Keep searching. Listen, man, I can't wait to. I know you're on the road a lot, and I'll try to catch you. I also have to come to Fur Peace, and I've said this before. It's not that far away from me.
Listen, I am on the road. I'm up in Vermont today. But,
right.
But. You've got my phone number. You could call me. You could text me. If you're coming up for something, you know, like our little shows are always sold out and stuff.
Right.
But hey, you know somebody in upper middle management. I got you.
Okay, I'll do that. I got to come up there and check it out now that you've got where you want it. I will absolutely do that, Jorma Kalkinen. Thanks so much, man, for being available and just being a part of my life musically as we all progress along the way. I've followed you for a long time and appreciate what you're doing.
Well, thanks, man, and we'll need to talk again at some point. That's not way too long.
We will do that. 5 years is too long.
Yes, it is.
I'll see you, Armin. Thanks a lot, man.
Yeah, man, thanks. Bye.